I'm Kay Puttock for KHOI Community Radio, and this is KHOI's Heart of Iowa, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and people of note in central Iowa. Welcome. Today my guest is Dr. Varadaraja Raman, known to his friends as V.V. Raman, who's a scientist and philosopher. By profession, he was a theoretical physicist. And he's a professor emeritus at Rochester Institute of Technology, where he was a professor of physics and humanities. And he's an Ames resident at least part of the time, and also in Rochester, I believe.
That's right.
Some of the memberships that he's had are the International Society for Science and Religion, the Interfaith Forum in Rochester, and he's also teaching classes, or he will be teaching classes at OLI, the Osher Lifelong Institute here in Ames. And we'll talk about that maybe later. But today I'd like to concentrate mostly on your, I think it's your most recent book, Truth and Tension in Science and Religion. Well, welcome, V.V. I'm so glad you could come.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
When I was rereading your book, I was struck again by your immense knowledge of religious diversity, different religions around the world, and different religious philosophies around the world. And I'd like you, as a sort of introduction, to talk about your own background and your upbringing that you think contributed to this worldview that you have.
Yes, certainly. I grew up in a home which was essentially Hindu. My parents were both Orthodox Hindus, my father especially. But my father was also a scholar, both of English literature and economics, and he introduced me to many aspects of literature generally and also philosophy. On the one hand, he inculcated in me the values and the traditional modes of Hinduism. At the same time, he said I should expand my interests and sensitivities to other cultures. And so I was sent to a Jesuit school for a couple of years, where I studied with the Jesuit fathers and learned quite a bit about the more beautiful aspects of Christianity and had to study Latin and so on. So right from the beginning and in the environment in which I grew up in the city of Calcutta in India, where the culture was Bengali, whereas my own parents were from the Tamil tradition, I had the opportunity to be not just exposed, but to also develop sensitivity and respect for a variety of cultures and languages. That's how it became. And of course, later on, I studied physics, which opened my mind to other things.
Right. Yes, I feel a little inadequate about the scientific aspects of your book, about talking about those. But as you were talking about your background, it reminded me somewhat of the little I know about Gandhi's background. We came from a home with a lot of religious diversity among his parents and their friends.
You are absolutely right. And in fact, it is, on the one hand, it may sound flattering to be compared to Gandhi. On the other hand,
I made the comparison.
No, but on the other hand, it is also, it was not unusual in those days the first half of the 20th century. This was fairly common. There were many people in India who were exposed to whatever was best in the Hindu Indic traditions, but also to whatever was best in the Western traditions, in spite of our animosity, if you will, with the British in terms of the occupation of India,
right,
the colony. But as far as cultures are concerned, people were very open in those days, especially.
And I remember I took a class with you at the Oshi, the OLI, on Hinduism.
Yeah.
And I remember you quoted from, I think it's the Mahabharata, about something about waters falling from the sea. Can you remember that quotation?
Yes. Well, in Sanskrit, if you like, so it goes like this: Akashat patitam toyam yada gacchati sagaram sarvadeva namaskara sri keshavam pradigacchati. What it means, or translated, would be as waters falling from the clouds, go back to the selfsame sea, prostrations to God by any name would lead to the same divinity. So the idea essentially is that as long as one is in a worship mode, in a religious and pious attitude, then it really does not matter what name and form you choose to pray. It is all ultimately the same spiritual entity to which we are paying homage. That's the idea.
You know, that's a very beautiful concept. Yeah. And perhaps I'm over-idealizing here, but it seems to me, and I think maybe to others, that Hinduism, because it's in some sense a polytheistic religion, in other words, recognizes all sorts of different aspects, you might say, of the deity, it's perhaps inherently more tolerant than Abrahamic tradition religions, where there's an emphasis there's only one true God, rather than the idea that any expression of God is approximating the truth.
Yes.
I think
there is much truth in what you say. I like to use a different word from polytheistic in that it usually gives, at least for the Western or Abrahamic mind, a negative connotation.
Right.
But in fact, what it is not different gods, but rather the manifestation or the visions of gods in different ways.
Right.
So the more appropriate word for it would be, it's a different word, not in most dictionaries, that is polyodosistic. Polyodosism means many paths, literally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, odos meaning a path,
right,
like in our odometer in a
right.
car. So polyodosism means that one can attain spiritual fulfillment by following different paths. And to me, this is a very crucial and key concept in religious thought. And much as I respect the various religions, the major religions of the world, all religions of the world, major or minor, what is very important to realize, even with the utmost faith in only one God or Savior or Prophet or whatever, is to realize that other people, for other reasons, historical, cultural reasons mainly, have other modes of expressing their religious yearning in different ways. And we need to learn to respect that.
Yes. And I think we'd agree that most thinking people agree that this is the primary need of our time.
I really think
to respect one another's religions.
Yeah, absolutely. I really think this is of the utmost urgency in our own times. It is possible to be faithful and respectful of one's own religion, and it's not just possible, it's the most natural thing to do. But at the same time, it is equally important to realize that there is what is unique is this yearning or longing of the human spirit for something beyond,
right,
and not the particular way by which it is done. And I often give this comparison that we, one simple and the other on a larger scale. The simple thing is we are all attached to our own families, our own parents, who are dearest to you, your own parents, which is natural. But to insist that everybody else should be as affectionate of your parents and forget their own,
right,
doesn't make sense. And so it's somewhat like that.
Yeah, so it's natural to have loyalty, you might say, to your own religion, but respect for the others. Yeah, and I mean, thinking of your own family, especially when you think of your own extended family, you can see the fault, perhaps, of your children or even of your parents, depending on, you know, who your parents are and so on. But however, whatever the faults of your children, they are, in a sense, dearer to you. So
yeah.
That is a good analogy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I remember once when I asked you just casually what you thought about people changing their religions. I don't know if you remember this, and you said, "I don't believe in jumping out of the frying pan into the fire." I'm not sure if you want to stay by that analogy. So now, and something else you say in your book, which I think is very worth emphasizing, because it seems a very foreign concept to some people who are interested in religion, and that is that not all religions are theistic. I think that's a difficult idea for a lot of people to grasp. In other words, a belief in God is not a necessity for a religious or spiritual life. And I wondered if you could say more about that and about the kinds of religions you're thinking of.
Yes. Most importantly, we know that Buddhism is non-theistic. Some say it is atheistic. But it is said that the Buddha, when asked about God, he said something to the effect that there are so many things you have to worry about in this world, and take care of those and don't worry about God at this point. So to an extent, some Jains regard their religion as atheistic. So is Confucianism, perhaps, and Shinto. There are religions which don't emphasize so much about a supernatural being as about what needs to be done in this world of ours, was extending caring and compassion. And I think that dimension of religion, which is, I believe in all religions, caring for fellow human beings, but the emphasis on something beyond, irrespective of its validity or sustainability on scientific grounds, is regarded as unnecessary in some religions.
Perhaps we should define, or I'd like you to define what you mean by religion, which would embrace non-theistic religions.
To me, religion is an expression of the human yearning to connect with the cosmic whole. In other words, we are all, as individuals, engaged in a variety of activities to satisfy our many physical, psychological, and emotional needs. But at the same time, we are also thinking, and in that sense, spiritual beings who like to go beyond our immediate concerns and needs and reflect on something beyond. And then there is the view, there is the experience of being in some way isolated in this little planet of ours, in the vastness of the universe, and there is therefore an inner need to be part of that larger whole.
Right.
The connectedness that we feel with respect to our families and friends and community extends beyond to the world at large.
Right. So,
and it is this feeling or this urge, this instinct or whatever it is, that gives rise to religious thought. That's the way
The wish to transcend the self,
exactly.
The limitations of the self. I think a lot of, especially a lot of people that call themselves atheists, would say that the main reason people are religious is because they're scared of dying. What would you say to that?
What did they say?
Because they're scared of dying. They're scared of death.
Yeah,
and scared of
There are psychologists and theorists who have said that religion comes from the need for a father figure. It comes from the fear of death, and many explanations of that kind. Perhaps it is not well, we have to distinguish between what might have been the roots of religion versus what religion is in actual practice.
What it can be, potentially.
And what it often is in actual practice. I don't think most religious people, practicing religious people, are constantly obsessed with the idea of death.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
But they do think once in a while about what might happen to their individual consciousnesses once they die. And that is why in many, many religions, there are views, visions, theories, whatever you will, about what will happen to the individual after death. So that's an important aspect of most religions, by no means the only or the primary.
Yes, I think I'd agree with that. Now, talking about, you know, definition of religion and the spiritual life and so on, you say quite a bit in your book, too, about mystery, and you distinguish between, you know, mystery is not, I think you said, magic mongering, and it's not confusion. It's something else, mystery in the religious, spiritual sense of the word.
Yes, I believe, because the word mystery is used in a variety of meanings, variety of contests, and even in the old Greek world and so on, and that were the mysteries of the Orphic tradition and so on. But what I mean by mystery is that there are certain questions that intrigue the human mind which cannot be answered in simple terms. And by mystery, I mean not the answer to it in terms of what I call magic mongering or all kinds of, whether they're superstitions or theories of the supernatural and so on, but a question like what will happen to us after we die, for example, or why is it that we happen to be right here in this universe at this time in cosmic history?
Mm-hmm.
These are things, the questions that are interesting, that are profoundly interesting for the reflective mind, but they are mysteries.
Right.
The moment we answer a mystery, it becomes a religious doctrine. In fact, we may define religions as answers to the mysteries. In so far as those answers are satisfying to people, I see nothing wrong with them. In my own case, I regard some mysteries as unanswerable in my physical frame. And if there is anything beyond, I might find out about it at a future date, but I am certainly not in a hurry to find that out.
And going back to Buddha, we shouldn't concern, he would say we shouldn't concern ourselves too much with that. Do you have any responses to the idea of the sacred or to the idea of reverence?
Absolutely. I think human life would be utterly meaningless if we did not have the notion of the sacred. And reverence comes automatically, I think, to any reflecting human being. Awe is always there. Nobody can look at the skies or even at the sunset or even at a flower or a butterfly and remain unawed. There is so much beauty and splendor in the universe. And then out of that awe comes a deep respect for whatever is behind all this awe. And that, I think, is what we mean by reverence. It is a respect that goes beyond the formal ways of being respectful, but
right.
It is something that we offer to the world at large and to people even, to the so-called, to whom we regard as higher people who have attained higher levels of spiritual life and so on.
Well,
so
of course, it's a sort of title for priests and ministers, reverend souls. Yeah, they're professionally reverent people.
But I think what is implied is that those people represent symbolically the sacred in the community. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about a reverend so-and-so, we mean that here is a person who symbolizes or who exemplifies or, in simpler terms, who officiates for whatever is sacred in their religion. Sacredness, on the other hand, is something which deserves reverence and which is traditionally associated with God and religion and so on, and but which can also be seen as aspects of human life for which we have so much reverence and respect that we dare not interfere with it in any way. So not touching that which we call sacred is the by not touching, I mean not disrespecting and not ill-treating in any way. Anything that's contrary to that is what we call a sacrilege.
Right. You know, there's this sort of saying, is nothing sacred when people sort of violate what you feel are. And certainly I mean, I'm very unconventional about religious things, but there's something about Sundays, the Sabbath, that even though I'm retired now, that is mustn't be violated. You know, that's a day when I don't do much.
Certainly,
even though I'm retired, that Sunday feels special. It's a day when I don't have to feel a bit guilty about not doing anything.
That is, of course, from the Judeo-Christian tradition from which you come, and perhaps similarly, there are Thursdays would be sacred in the Hindu tradition often, and I think.
Or Fridays, I believe.
Friday for
Muslims.
Islam. Yeah. And if we do not, aside from the days and practice and behavior, sacredness is extremely important for also restraining in some way our indiscriminate actions and behaviors, because we are expected not to do certain things because that would be against the sacredness. Of course, Walt Whitman once said that if anything is sacred, the human body is sacred. And that is true, I think, in that we should respect the integrity of humanity. But an animal's body could also be sacred.
Right.
It all depends on.
Right.
Well, there are many, many things sacred. There are also sacredness in behavior,
right.
and I think it was Dostoevsky who said, if you take away sacredness, anything is permitted, or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm. And I think everyone would agree that there's something sacred about the bond between parents and their children. Now, obviously, sometimes people are incompetent parents, but we're very hesitant to disrupt that bond. Or to interfere with that because there's something sacred about it.
Yeah, exactly. Sacredness is an important element in human culture.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, on the other hand, you also say in your book, you stress the importance of secularism. And I've got a quote here from your book. Secularism is perhaps the most civilized principle of good in all of history. And so I'd like you to talk about secularism, because some people would say that secularism is the complete opposite of religion and secular people are not religious and so on.
Yes. The word is used in a variety of contexts and today, and it has been misused and so on. My concept of secularism here is somewhat influenced by what may be called American and today in India, and other Western modes of government. And by secularism, I mean dimensions of everyday life, which including the laws of the land the principles by which the country is governed and so on, they should not be influenced or directed, more exactly, by any religious establishment or the laws of traditional laws of any religion. This is not to disrespect religions, but to say that we should make a clear-cut separation between the laws governing a modern civilized society and the religious injunctions derived from scriptures. And this becomes all the more important in societies where there are people of different religions.
Exactly.
It is possible to be purely what the opposite in this context would be, a theocratic society. Maybe okay as long as there are only people of one particular religion, more exactly one particular sect, because sometimes in theocratic societies, people of different sects are persecuted. This is common all over the world. So that is what I meant there.
So it's more or less what Americans call the separation of church and state.
Essentially. It is in that context that I mean that this is a highly civilized form, because all through history, there was either because there was no need or because there was the power which was wielded by religious establishments.
Right.
And therefore, wherever that was the case, those belonging to a minority group, whether in whatever culture, they felt insecure. And that it is therefore related to humanity being first. And in that sense, I said.
Yeah, and some people say that because of the separation of church and state in the United States, that is why all sorts of religion flourishes so much in America, as opposed to Europe, where, well, except more Christianity sort of seems to be dying out.
Yeah. Religion is certainly allowed to flourish, but we still insist, I think, that the laws which are applicable to all citizens trump over religious laws, if should such a conflict arise. That is the fundamental idea here.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I mentioned, I don't feel very competent to talk about the scientific aspects of your book, but I will say, I at least when I was reading it, your distinction between hypothesis and theory, that's the first time I think I've understood that, really. At least I thought I was understanding. I understood it while I was reading it. But I'd like you to talk about, your book is called Tension in Science and Religion.
Truth and Tension in
Science and Religion. And I'd like you to talk a bit about what you see as the relationship between science and religion in the modern world.
Yes, as you know, this is a very, very, not very elegant phrase, hot topic in today's world. Science and religion in most traditional societies, starting from the age of the Greeks and Romans to India and medieval Europe and so on, they were more or less going together, if only because the people who were religiously the leaders and thinkers were also, for the most part, scientists in the sense of inquirers about the mystery of existence, about the natural world and so on.
Right.
But as we know, from the 17th century onwards, there was, after what's generally called the modern scientific revolution, the two began to drift apart.
To diverge.
And that is because religion has many dimensions, one of which is explaining the world, not all of which, one of which. Science has ultimately only one principal goal, and that is to explain natural phenomena.
Right.
Now, it turns out that the scientific mode of explaining which emerged in the 17th century is considerably different or the explanations arrived at by the scientific mode are very different from the explanations given before, because in earlier, in what may be called ancient science, the criteria of experimentation, of verifiability, of challenging an authority, these things were not there in the ancient world, and which are intrinsic to the religious framework. And so the two had to divide. Now, in the course of the next few centuries, science began to amass such a vast amount of information about the universe at large, and also not just natural phenomena, but about human beings, about how the human body works and how the human mind works and so on. This has had a tremendous impact on the religious framework.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it has begun to question not only the seven-day creation, but other things about the man being unique
right.
in the universe
right.
and that the world was created for man alone, human beings alone. Those ideas, man is just the ex-ape of creation, as somebody said, whereas religion would say man is the apex of creation. And so that is where the difference comes.
Well, do you think science can be a kind of dogma in the bad sense? Or, you know, are the scientific, what you might call myths in the bad sense of the term?
It is a charge brought against science by many people in the modern world, philosophers and others, in that science imagines as an institution, and many practicing scientists, that that is the only true path to understanding the world. And to that extent, or on that basis, it is said that science is a dogma. But we have to distinguish between dogma in a negative sense and assumptions to explain something. A dogma is something that we accept as the truth, which cannot be challenged.
Right. So that
in science, what is a dogma is, if you want to say, the only dogma is that the scientific methodology is the only way of gaining complete understanding of the physical world. That, I think, we can say that is a dogma in the sense of a deep belief of working scientists, which is justified, if at all, by the fact that on the basis of that methodology, human beings have acquired more knowledge and understanding of the world in the past three centuries than ever before.
Right.
So that is in the justification for holding on to that belief. There are people who think that science, there are many challenges that science is still facing, such as the origin of human consciousness.
Yes.
Now, there are people who are convinced that this can never be understood on the basis of normal, so-called normal scientific methodology, but we need to go beyond. So those are, and science, I think, would be open to other investigations
mm-hmm.
if they can lead to really a deeper understanding.
Mm-hmm. What do you think religion can do for us that science cannot do?
I think religion does many, many things, as long as the other aspect I referred to is religion is what brings us all together as a community. Religion is what enables us to cope with extremely difficult circumstances in life over which we have no control. Religion is a vehicle for collective jubilation on happy mm-hmm. occasions. And religion certainly was at one time the root of many of our ethical principles, even though some have to be changed and they have expanded.
Right.
But religion has contributed considerably to human culture, if you let alone to great art and music and architecture and so on.
Right.
So I don't think it is appropriate to trivialize religion as some modern thinkers tend to do. But it's a matter of how religion is used, if that's a word, or how we take the best out of the religious framework.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps this would be a good place to fit this in. I should say, actually, that my guest is Vivi Ramon, and we're talking about religious diversity and tolerance and the intersection or the interrelationship of science and religion. But this might be a good time to talk about a little bit about, you know, there's a number of vocal atheists in print nowadays. Well, Christopher Hitchens has recently died, but Christopher Hitchens is one of them, and Richard Dawkins, I can't think of the names of others, who would say what we need to do is eradicate religion, I think. And certainly, I think we both agree that, you know, this religion has done harm in the past at certain, and that we need to get rid of those intolerant aspects of, and those oppressive aspects of religion. But what do you think is the best answer to people that say we should do without religion altogether? Now, the immediate answer that comes to my mind is you can't. It will always come. You can't do without. But aside from that, what?
Well, I personally have great regard for many of the writings of the authors you mentioned. Even though when I was reading Hitchens' book, God is Not Great,
mm-hmm.
which was, I don't know if people know, it is, it was meant especially to insult one particular religion,
right.
which says God is great. But his book, again, it is the best manifesto I can think of for modern atheism.
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely well written, and Hitchens was a great...
He's a very good writer,
yeah. good thinker, and a no-nonsense person when it comes to religion. But he also, you know, in that book, if you look into it again, you will find the word stupid used at least a dozen times. I don't think that is really good English, quite frankly, because if you read Bertrand Russell's Science and Religion, you know, of a generation ago,
mm-hmm.
that is dignified language. He doesn't use words like stupid. But that aside, while I happen to agree with the negative things these great authors, thinkers say about religion, I am sorry that they have nothing positive to say.
Right.
To me...
They're only looking at half the picture, it seems.
Yeah,
to me.
And it seems to me that let's say the garbage collector comes to the conclusion that every house in this neighborhood, all they do is produce garbage. And that's absolutely...
that's true. They all produce garbage.
They all produce garbage. That is true. But to say that they only produce garbage
right.
is not quite knowing. You have to go inside and see how the people live and
right.
so on. So it is somewhat like that.
That's a good analogy. You have to get inside to
see the good qualities.
Yes,
everything the negative they say
is from the outside.
Happens to be true.
Yes,
to be true. But that's not the only thing. It is like saying somebody who has no understanding of science, saying that look what science has done. It's produced so much pollution. It made the nuclear bombs,
mm-hmm.
weapons. We have to ban science. So it is the equivalent of that in a way.
Uh-huh.
And Therefore, let me repeat, I would be the first to agree with all the negative things that they have said about religion. It's a sad fact that in the history of religion, practically every religion one can say, there have been terrible things.
There have, yes.
And this is not argument enough to reject religion. And as you rightly said, you cannot reduce or eradicate religions by a diktat.
No.
It's just not possible.
No. People are always going to make new ones.
And what is important is how we take the best.
Right.
Because religion and science are some of the greatest expressions of the human spirit, as
exactly,
I say it.
Yes. Okay. Talking of taking the best, you, again, referred in your book to the 1993 Revived Parliament of World Religions. I believe the first Parliament of World Religions was the one in the 19th century that...
Yeah, 1894,
that 93.
Yeah.
Such a sensation. 1893, the Hindu sage Vivekananda made such a sensation. And that was the first time the West, many people in the West had known anything about Hinduism and they were so impressed by his presentation. So that was the first one. And then it stopped for a while. And there's a new one in 1993, the Parliament in Chicago, as the original one had been. And they made a joint declaration of the religions for a global ethic. I'd like to talk a bit about that. But for a start, what do you think is the main responsibility today for world's religious leaders?
And you use the right word, religious leaders, because ultimately it is not the millions of practitioners of religion who are at fault, if at all, when you talk about some of the modern manifestations. It is what the leaders say, because the vast majority of religious practitioners simply do what they are asked to do. And it is only in those cases where the people are, there is a growing percentage of thinking, reflecting people, that they ask the leaders to change. Like there is a movement in the United States now, the women Catholics want the new Pope to be different.
Mm-hmm.
See, this kind of a movement by the practitioners to guide the leaders doesn't often happen. Generally, it is the leaders who guide or instigate or inspire, as the case may be, the followers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unless the religious leaders themselves preach tolerance, mutual tolerance amongst the religions, there is very little hope. And I don't know of any major religious leaders. We know that in the Unitarians preach and practice it. We know that the Baha'is preach it. And we know that the Hinduism has it at its core, this thing. But this should also come into Christianity and Islam, I think, for the greater benefit of humankind and, I think, for the enlightenment of their own followers.
This is the great responsibility of religious leaders today is teaching tolerance and acceptance.
Well, I like to think with movements like interfaith movements and the Parliament of World Religion and so on, we can not just hope, we can be sure that this will happen in the course of this century. Not religions won't be eradicated, but religions will learn to respect others and to live with one another.
Thank you. I've got another quote here from your book, and this was in the context of the revived Parliament of Religions. Everything that is of universal ethical value in different religions can be upheld without doctrinal or metaphysical assertions.
Yes, I think the essence of the ethical framework of most religions are more human and humanistic,
right,
human-oriented. Whether it is, be good to your neighbor or don't mm-hmm. tell the truth, honor your parents, things of that kind.
Right, and even when you're thinking about these terms we were talking about before, like the sacred and reverence, yeah. If you have reverence in human relationships,
absolutely,
these things are necessary to have.
Yeah.
Analogy I like to make is about when you're thinking about reverence is if you think about the difference between, say, pornography and art, but the same kind of subject, say, a nude painting. What is the difference? Well, it's the attitude. It's an yeah. attitude of reverence.
Exactly,
reverence the human body. Or,
yeah.
This is the part, the only part that really could glean anything from the scientific part of your book, is when you were talking about perceptions and human perceptions of beauty in the world. And I don't think you exactly said this. In fact, I think I was sort of disagreeing with something you said there, that you said something like whether what we perceive in the world as beautiful would be beautiful without human perception is not clear. But I think it's very interesting that bees are attracted to flowers, for example, because of their scent and because of their color. Apparently butterflies, and people have done experiments with this, butterflies are attracted to their mates because of the bright color, and if you cover up those bright colors, they're not attracted to that, and so on. It seems very wonderful to me that what makes insects attracted to flowers and what makes insects attracted to one another and birds attracted to one another is the same thing that looks beautiful to us. This doesn't seem at all... Maybe it's necessary because of the way we evolved, But that seems very wonderful and not necessary. Although I suppose there are exceptions. I mean, there are flowers that smell like rotten meat to humans.
Yeah, to humans,
That attract insects that the plants eat. So there are exceptions.
Yeah, and that's...
But there's very little of that, it seems.
But that's what the idea of Darwinian evolution is, exactly that. And all these various attractions and repulsions are related to the ways by which individuals can safeguard their own existence and can also propagate their species.
But when we just look at the diversity that's produced by this, it seems like a gift most of it seems so beautiful. Of course, there's a lot of cruelty in nature.
And that is the argument often against religion, that the scientific atheists say that how can a merciful God create a world with that much cruelty
mm-hmm.
or with the disasters that can cause deaths and destruction. And that, to me, is, again, one of the mysteries. It is a mystery if we believe in a God who is always merciful. But it is not a mystery if you take it as a natural phenomenon, which right. Nature, as such, is fairly indifferent to the human condition.
Right. But there's a kind of beauty about it, even in its...
But the beauty is,
In its terrible aspects, Well, I'd like to spend a little time talking about the courses you're going to be teaching at OLI, at the Lifelong Learning Institute. As I said, you taught classes on Hinduism, which I very much enjoyed, but this time you're doing a couple of different things.
Yes. I always give two courses, one related to science, another to humanities, and... So it was that last time I talked about the laws of thermodynamics, which is for, essentially science, physics. And then I also taught about the Ramayana, the great scripture, epic in the Hindu world. This time I'm going to in one course talk about the magic of numbers, how to play with, how we can have.
That's what I need.
Tremendous.
I don't know if you'll see me there. That's what I need, probably.
Yeah, because numbers are more than just counting or paying, you know, at the store. Numbers are have their own separate existence, and there are many, many wonderful things we can do with numbers. Myself, as a personal note, my meditation in the morning, every morning for 5 to 10 minutes, I meditate on some number.
Really?
Yeah, because to me, that is the most abstract and beautiful thing that one can think of.
Yes.
And so numbers, that's one. And the other course I'm going to be giving is Appreciating Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is so much beyond the plays of Shakespeare, a lot more in terms of his own life, the controversies, the impact Shakespeare had on the English language. And,
So, and there's so many things that have become cliches.
Exactly,
people don't realize they're quoting Shakespeare.
Yeah.
There was one I just heard of the other day. Oh, yes, dead as a doornail, apparently. I can't think where that comes from, but apparently it was Shakespeare that
said
that.
Yeah, yeah, so many, exactly. Yeah. So many expressions and so many even words like laughable and all that he used. Had made adjectives out of nouns and verbs.
Oh, yes, he used any part of speech for any
and it words. And it all sounds so beautiful when it properly does, enunciated.
Yes.
So I thought that would be interesting to discuss together.
Yeah, if I could just go back to numbers for a minute. There was something in your book about numerology, too, the magic of numbers,
yeah.
I suppose. And that brought up the idea of whether there really aren't seven colors in the spectrum. There's really only six. They just wanted seven, so they said indigo and violet, although you can hardly distinguish between them.
Yes, but also it is related to the cultural prejudice, which makes seven a holy, sacred number, which is related to the Babylonian understanding of the seven planets, before the
seven wonders of the world.
All these all these things come from the original discovery of the Babylonians that there are seven celestial bodies which move differently, which they called, which later on the Greeks called the planets, namely the sun, the moon, Venus, Mercury, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, these seven, not all of which are planets by today's reckoning, but they thought these are the planets. And they dedicated one day to each of these planets, which were deified, and that's how we get the 7 days of the week.
Like Monday is the moon,
and so on.
Which is similar in many European languages.
Yeah, exactly, because the same culture. And therefore, seven becomes sacred. So when even Newton analyzed the numbers, the seven, the spectra of light, white light, so he made it seven also, seven. Mm-hmm. So it fits in with the
seven. This sounds like a fascinating course.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for coming and talking to us today. And we feel really lucky to have you here in Ames. Thank you so much for joining us today on Heart of Iowa.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to Heart of Iowa. I'm Kay Puttock, and I've been talking to Dr. V.V. Raman. The music we've heard was a tabla solo from the Ravi Shankar San Francisco collection and an instrumental rendition of Into the West from the music of the Lord of the Rings. This show was engineered by Rick Morrison. Until next time, goodbye from the Heart of Iowa.